The word fiat is growing more aggrandized in the modern lexicon. However, despite its increasing popularity, it is often ill-defined or misused. I regularly observe people falsely call Bitcoin a fiat currency. This is thanks not least of all to the layman's poor grasp of history and money. Fiat is of Latin origin, meaning authoritative sanction, a decree, command, or order. Fiat does not mean backed by nothing, or redeemable for nothing, or pegged to nothing. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, everybody? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible, the center of the Bitcoin audioverse. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know, and we have got an awesome one today. This one, top vote on BitcoinAudible.com/vote. Thank you for everybody who shared their opinion. We got one from Heavily Armored Clown. He's Heavily Armored Clown on the Twits. And Medium and all the things, actually. You know him from WTF Happened in 1971. He and Ben Prentice manage that, and they're all over the place. There's so many great shows. In fact, if you go to WTF Happened in 1971, there's lots of different links to different episodes and podcasts and everything that they have been on. I was on What Bitcoin Did with him and Ben and had a great time. But we got a really cool article here. They're always fire on this issue, and this one walks us through a bit of monetary history of the United States. And it not only does it kind of walk us through all of the repetitive credit expansion and debt cycles of the United States and why these things happened, but it also kind of sheds a light on the very idea of the term fiat, what it means, and how the inevitable problems that arise from the fiat rule of a monetary good, how those problems have arisen in the U.S. monetary system over and over throughout its history, and how Bitcoin may actually be a ray of hope at righting the incentives and putting an end to the fiat cycle. A quick thank you to SwanBitcoin.com for supporting the show. If you do not buy Bitcoin automatically, you are doing it wrong. Set up a savings plan at SwanBitcoin.com/guy, and it will secure your sovereign future and help out the Bitcoin Audible show at the same time. And then you want to get an auto withdrawal to your BitBox hardware wallet. Shift Crypto makes the BitBox OV2 the beautiful, secure device for your cold storage. It's open source hardware that's easy to use. It keeps your funds safe. It's just, you just sleep soundly at night, you know, knowing that an exchange won't blunder some numbers, a hacker won't steal, or your government can't freeze your account, your Bitcoin savings, because they're safe in your possession on your BitBox. Check out both of our sponsors at guyswan.com. Right at the top of the page, you'll get some goodies yourself and also support the show. With that, it's time to get into today's article, and it is titled Fiat Lux, The Origins of Modern Money by Heavily Armored Clown. The word fiat is growing more aggrandized in the modern lexicon. However, despite its increasing popularity, it is often ill-defined or misused. I regularly observe people falsely calling Bitcoin a fiat currency. This is thanks not least of all to the layman's poor grasp of history and money. Fiat is of Latin origin, meaning authoritative sanction, a decree, command, or order. Fiat does not mean backed by nothing, or redeemable for nothing, or pegged to nothing. The phrase fiat lux is a Latin reference to some of the most prolific words ever written. From the book of Genesis in the Bible, let there be light. We can see here how the word is used authoritatively. There was no light, and God commanded that there should be light, and there was light. Unfortunately for us, or perhaps to our great fortune, man's emulation of the spoken word of God carries with it far less divine authority, and thus decrees of sapient origin must be enforced by coercion, which today usually comes in the form of complex legal and judicial systems. As long as men have ruled over one another with force, there have been decrees in this manner. A decree can be as simple as making a particular day an observed holiday. Likewise, it can be as foolish and convoluted as saying the sky must be green on a Tuesday. Here is the insufferable nature of humanity laid bare. Man can make a decree, but he cannot necessarily make it so. Mankind does not manifest ends through his words, but rather via his action. Certainly, a ruler could devote vast amounts of his kingdom's resources towards advancing the ends of his decrees, but his means may make it no more achievable than if he had nothing at all. In fact, a very charismatic and narcissistic leader might succeed in assuaging resistance against absurd and impossible schemes of a great variety. History is full of egocentric megalomaniacs proclaiming fiat lux into the darkness. However, for our purposes, it is necessary to focus on a more particular topic, and that is the more recent, modern history of money, particularly in the United States. The word fiat is perhaps so widely misunderstood because the history of money is correspondingly misunderstood. In fact, by uncovering why the word fiat is so commonly ill-defined, we might just uncover truths of supreme importance. Despite what you may believe, the first fiat currency of the United States following the birth of the nation was not in 1971, 1933, or 1913, but instead in 1792. The Coinage Act of 1792, proposed by Alexander Hamilton, established a pegged exchange rate of 15 to 1 silver to gold. When viewed through the modern lens, it is not at first obvious how this would be considered a fiat currency. After all, monies made from metal are not worthless paper. This simply must mean that it is impossible for a gold or silver money to be fiat. However, this is untrue. Remember what the term fiat actually means: by decree. It was by decree that the exchange rate between gold and silver coinage was decided by the United States government, rather than by a free, open, and voluntary marketplace. This act of price fixing places a face value premium on one coinage or the other, relative to the underlying cost of the bullion struck into coins. In this particular case, it was a premium placed on the face value of silver coins over the value of the silver bullion required to mint them. This is inherently inflationary. This premium had ultimately dilutive effects on the circulating face value of silver, as you will see. To understand how layers of decree abstracted away our understanding of money, we must review just a sliver of the history underlying the process of transition from bimetallism to a gold standard, to a pseudo-gold standard, and to ultimately irredeemable paper notes. Our primary source for this history will be Rothbard's History of Money and Banking in the United States. Tokugawa Coinage. At a cursory glance, it's not a simple matter to parse how soft and expansionary commodity money policy achieved through bimetallic pegs can be severely detrimental. Nor is it necessarily a simple matter to grasp how coinage exchange rates, set by decree, were a rudimentary form of the fiat money in wide use today. To sort this matter out, it is helpful for us to look for an extreme historical example. In 1860, the Empire of Japan opened up its borders for the first time to free and unregulated global trade in the modern world. Traditionally, Japan had set its exchange rate on gold to silver coinage at 1 to 5, while international rates at the time were set to 1 to 15. Consider for a moment the implications of this decree when exposed to market forces. the artificially cheap gold Koban coins could be exchanged for the artificially soft silver Tenpo coins at a 200% profit. Effectively, one could take 5 parts silver and exchange it for gold, carrying an arbitrage trade against the rest of the world's 1 to 15 gold to silver peg. In fact, this is exactly what happened. In 1860, 4 million gold ryos, a Japanese unit of weight, left the country, equivalent to approximately 70 tons of gold. In response, the bakufu, the Japanese shogunate ruling class, chose to debase the gold contents of the koban by 2/3, bringing it in line with the foreign, and more realistically market-adjusted, gold and silver exchange rates. At this point, however, the damage had been done. Final settlement occurred in the form of the harder money moving out of the country by the shipload. Keep this story in mind as we make our way through the various shifts in American monetary policies throughout the 19th and 20th century. The Panic of 1792 and 1796. The first National Bank of the United States was signed into charter by Washington under the direction of Alexander Hamilton, which set in motion a massive inflationary speculative boom. Private investors were allowed to purchase stock in the National Bank. However, only 1/4 of the cost had to be paid in specie, gold and silver. The other 3/4 of the cost was to be paid in government debt securities. Rampant speculation surrounding National Bank stock ensued, and it was unsustainable. The speculation would have liquidated itself had it been allowed to run its course. Alexander Hamilton worked closely with a New York financier, William Seton, to authorize the purchase of $150,000 of public debt with government revenue, a first great step in the marriage of government and private enterprise. By 1792, the expansion of credit made available to speculators by the Bank of the United States in excess of $2.17 million nearly bankrupted the Bank of New York. And from December 29th to March 9th, cash reserves for the Bank of the United States decreased by 34%, prompting the bank to not renew nearly 25% of its outstanding debts. Speculators were then forced to sell off securities in order to satisfy outstanding debts, and the deflationary contraction began. In March, Hamilton then authorized an additional $100,000 in open market purchases of securities and heavily encouraged the Bank of New York to continue offering loans, collateralized with U.S. debt. Hamilton also promised the Treasury would buy up to $500,000 of securities from the Bank of New York, thus staving off the liquidation for a short time. The following few years were characterized by even more rampant speculation and malinvestment in the bank's stock, government debt securities, and paper land claims, corresponding to the ongoing westward expansion. As is typical, new credit and capital dried up, as a war-torn Europe grew weary of American speculative instruments, and paper land claims began to depreciate in value rapidly. In 1797, British Parliament suspended redemption of specie, which lasted until 1821, and the complete undoing of the speculative credit expansion and paper financial instrument bubble followed. The Panic of 1819. The Panic of 1819 was caused by a massive monetary expansion created by banks during the Napoleonic Wars, particularly the U.S.'s involvement in the War of 1812. The War of 1812 was essentially a trade war, the far less often discussed second war with Britain, who was blockading French-American trade routes in the greater context of the Napoleonic Wars. In order to procure the necessary goods required for the war, huge quantities of new banknotes were created in order to purchase government bonds. To quote Rothbard, quote, "From 1811 to 1815, the number of banks in the country increased from 117 to 212. In addition, there had sprung up 35 private unincorporated banks, which were illegal in most states but were allowed to function under war conditions. Specie in the 30 reporting banks, 26% of the total number of banks of 1811, amounted to $2.57 million in 1811. This figure had risen to $5.4 million in the 98 reporting banks in 1815, or 40% of the total. Notes and deposits, on the other hand, were $10.95 million in 1811 and had increased to $31.6 million in 1815 among the reporting banks. Essentially, the U.S. government was financing its war operations with massive amounts of inflated banknotes, which, when called due for final settlement in specie, sparked a near nationwide bank insolvency. In 1814, the U.S. government gave the go-ahead for all banks to temporarily suspend redemption of specie, but to remain open and continue their expansion of debt unabated. Rothbard explains. Reporting banks increased their pyramid ratios from 3.17 to 1 in 1814 to 5.85 to 1 the following year, a drop of reserve ratios from 0.32 to 0.17. Thus, if we measure bank expansion by pyramiding and reserve ratios, we see that a major inflationary impetus during the War of 1812 came during the year 1815, after specie payments had been suspended throughout the country by government action. Rothbard expounds that although during this particular point in time there was no central bank in the United States, the National Bank Charter had lapsed under Jefferson, and misinformed historians often point to this as the cause of unchecked credit expansion. This monetary policy was similar to other expansionary periods which happened under the First and Second National Bank, and later under the Federal Reserve System. Coercion by the federal government to secure wartime funding drove the massive expansion of banknotes and credit, despite the lack of a central bank overseeing the process in this particular instance. The federal government also issued large amounts of treasury notes, which were quasi-legal tender and redeemable in specie 1 year after issuance. These notes took on a monetary role and were widely circulated and drove specie out of circulation. See Gresham's Law. Rothbard. Wholesale price increases from 1811 to 1815 averaged 35%, with different cities experiencing a price inflation ranging from 28% to 55%. Since foreign trade was cut off by the war, prices of imported commodities rose far more, averaging 70%. But more important than this inflation, and at least as important as the wreckage of the monetary system during and after the war, was the precedent that the 2.5-year-long suspension of specie payments set for the banking system for the future. From then on, every time there was a banking crisis brought on by inflationary expansion and demands for redemption in specie, state and federal governments looked the other way and permitted general suspension of specie payments while bank operations continued to flourish. All of this new money and credit, in conjunction with rising commodity prices, set off an inflationary boom in 1817, which led to the deflationary bust in 1819 as the economy was snapped back to reality. Contraction of money and credit by the Bank of the United States was almost unbelievable, total notes and deposits falling from $21.9 million in June 1818 to $11.5 million only a year later. The money supply contributed by the Bank of the United States was thereby contracted by no less than 47.2% in 1 year. The number of incorporated banks at first remained the same, and then fell rapidly from 1819 to 1822, falling from 341 in mid-1819 to 267 3 years later. Total notes and deposits of state banks fell from an estimated $72 million in mid-1818 to $62.7 million a year later, a drop of 14% in 1 year. If we add in the fact that the U.S. Treasury contracted total Treasury notes from $8.81 million to zero during this period, we get the following estimated total money supply. In 1818, $103.5 million. In 1819, $74.2 million. A contraction in 1 year of 28.3%. The Panic of 1857. As is the inevitable case with all fiat currency schemes, monetary expansion was the natural outcome. Large outflows of gold and silver from Mexico due to the favorable premium on coinage in America led to an exchange rate debasement of 16 to 1 in 1834. And by the Coinage Act of 1853, all silver denominations were diluted further again. By the 1850s, nearly half of the states in the Union had transitioned to what was called free banking. An important distinction here is that free banking, in the context of its political rhetoric sources, was not what economists traditionally considered free banking at the time. The system of free banking that existed during this time period allowed the government to afford banks the, quote, general suspension of specie payments whenever the banks overexpanded and got into trouble, as pointed out by Rothbard. This means that during times of crisis, banks were no longer liable to redeem their outstanding paper money certificates for the underlying metals. Free banking brought, quote, a myriad of regulations, including edicts by state bank commissioners and high minimum capital requirements that greatly restricted entry into the banking business. In this way, competition in banking was heavily stifled by government intervention, and normally where overextended banks would fail during a time of liquidation, this liquidation was halted. But even more concerning, quote, the expansion of banknotes and deposits was directly tied to the amount of state government securities that the bank had invested in and posted as bond with the state. In effect, then, state government bonds became the reserve base upon which banks were allowed to pyramid a multiple expansion of banknotes and deposits. Not only did this system provide explicitly or implicitly fractional reserve banking, but the pyramid was tied rigidly to the amount of government bonds purchased by the bank. Effectively, a bank's ability to expand its credit and monetary base was directly tied to public debt. The more debt it purchased from the government, the more new money it could create. And in tandem, the more banks made use of this financial trickery, the more governments could expand their debt as well. This ability to expand credit and essentially soft default on that debt when it came due through the suspension of specie redemption is very important for what came next. Starting in 1848, the American gold rush was in full swing. A huge supply of new gold was introduced to the market, creating strong inflationary signals. Seemingly, economic conditions were good. Investors and speculators engaged in rampant overleveraging. By the mid-1850s, the supply of new gold began to dry up, and additionally, a large shipment of gold aboard the SS Central America was lost in the midst of a heavy storm. She was carrying approximately 30,000 pounds of gold to the shores of Eastern America at the time. In the midst of these two deflationary events, the railroad companies booming around the growing westward expansion experienced a speculative stock bubble. Thanks to the abundance of cheap credit and latent malinvestment, many of these companies were worth considerable amounts of money on paper, but had no physical assets with which to run their business. Railroad stock values peaked in July of 1857, and a slow market sell-off began. The gold standard. The subsequent fallout from these events lasted up until the Civil War, at which point virtually all specie redemption stopped. The National Bank Act of 1863 forbade the issuance of any new state banknotes, finally giving a full monopoly of monetary expansion to the federal government. With the groundwork having already been laid for paper money experiments in the colonial area, a topic which I've written about extensively in my blog but will not cover here, the U.S. switched from bimetallism to a paper currency backed by silver specie in order to fund the Civil War effort. This was colloquially known as the greenback system. Following the end of the war, the U.S. resumed redemption of specie but ended what was known as free silver, By 1873, the silver value of coins had dropped so low relative to their fiat face value that the U.S. soft abandoned bimetallism by ceasing the free and unlimited minting of silver coins with the Coinage Act of 1873. This was largely politically unpopular and led to 20 years of political strife over the alleged prosperity caused by monetary expansion under free silver. The Sherman Silver Act of 1890 ushered in a period of inflation by decreeing an increase in the amount of silver purchased by the U.S. government to the tune of 4.5 million ounces of bullion a month. This caused a sharp increase in the paper money supply of the U.S. and encouraged rampant speculation. The U.S. Treasury purchased the silver bullion using a special issue treasury note, which could then be redeemed for either gold or silver, and a run on the gold reserves of the U.S. began. Artificially overvalued silver drove gold out of circulation and into hoards. In the metals market, silver was now worth less than the fiat exchange rate of silver to gold. Investors would buy silver from the booming mining economy, exchange it for gold with the treasury, and then sell the gold claims for a profit. These profits were then reinvested in more silver, and on the cycle went. This continued until the treasury nearly ran out of gold. President Grover Cleveland repealed the Sherman Act to prevent further loss of federal gold reserves. By the end of 1890, the price of silver had dropped from $1.16 an ounce to 69 cents per ounce. By early 1894, the price had dropped to 60 cents. By November of 1895, U.S. mints entirely halted all production of silver coins and outright discouraged the use of silver dollars. Runs were made on the U.S. Treasury gold reserves, not just by silver speculators, but by European financiers as well, in anticipation of a spreading global financial turmoil. Concern over the weakening financial state of the United States led to bank runs and a nationwide liquidity squeeze, as the malinvestment wrought by monetary expansion began to purge. In the midst of this man-made regulatory fiscal crisis, global commodities prices, particularly that of wheat, tanked due to a cascade of liquidations in emerging markets. In 1894, the rate for a bushel of wheat dropped from its 14.7 cent 1893 price to 12.88 cent per bushel, continuing to fall all the way to 9.92 cent in 1901. Overleveraged U.S. farming operations dependent on high international commodity prices went belly up. By 1900, the U.S. established, for the first time, a gold standard. All right, let's take a quick break right here, and then we will get back in talking about the monetary expansion and what the new policies and dynamics were after the U.S. finally got on a gold standard. But for now, let's hit our sponsor. So all of these problems that he is breaking down about our U.S. monetary system, they were caused by the abstraction, the barrier between paper money and base layer money, or gold, and the ability to cheat that difference. Bitcoin on your BitBox O2 is the equivalent of holding gold in your hand. It is the new base layer money in your possession securely on your BitBox hardware wallet. In fact, it's actually better than having it in your hand because it's like having an impenetrable vault in your hand that has your gold inside it. And only you know how to open the vault. The BitBox O2 is a great hardware wallet for all the reasons that you hear about on this show damn near every day. But one of the biggest problems is human error, and something that is intuitive and easy to use seriously decreases that human error. That is the big thing to me for the BitBox O2. It is simple, it is intuitive, it is open source, and it's secure. Check them out at guyswan.com/bitbox, and don't forget code GUY gets you 5% off. The Panic of 1907. The Panic of 1907 was a period of monetary contraction leading to a financial and banking crisis which set the tone for the creation of a central bank in the United States, the Federal Reserve, with the previous national bank having been abolished under the Jackson presidency. The panic coincided with the annual harvest season, where money would flow out of the cities as harvests were purchased. To compensate for this, banks would raise interest rates. Taking advantage of these new interest rates, foreign investment became increasingly attracted to the New York markets. During this time, and as well across the first half of the decade, the U.S. saw a massive run-up of the Dow Jones, seen below. In April 1906, San Francisco had a 7.9 magnitude earthquake, prompting a large amount of money to make its way to the West Coast. In late 1906, the Bank of England also raised its interest rates, slowing foreign investment in New York City. That same year, the Interstate Commerce Commission passed the Hepburn Act, which allowed for a ceiling to be placed on railroad rates. The result was a devastating blow to the railroad securities valuations, and so began the market cascade. This was followed by a collapse in the price of copper, a failure in the New York City bond offering, June of 1906, and major antitrust fines against the Standard Oil Company. At the time, the national banking system had no ability to inject artificial liquidity into the system, and naturally, the liquidation was painful. This was much to the chagrin of many of the bankers throughout the country. Rothbard writes, quote, "In each of the banking panics after the Civil War, 1873, 1884, 1893, and 1907, there was a general suspension of specie payments. The panic of 1907 proved to be the most financially acute of them all. The bankers, almost to a man, had long agitated for going further than the national banking system, to go forward frankly and openly, surmounting the inner contradictions of the quasi-centralized system to a system of central banking. The bankers found that the helpful cartelization of the national banking system was not sufficient. A central bank, they believed, was needed to provide a lender of last resort, a federal governmental Santa Claus, who would always stand ready to bail out banks in trouble. Furthermore, a central bank was needed to provide elasticity of the money supply. A common complaint by bankers and by economists in the latter parts of the national banking era was that the money supply was inelastic. In plain English, this meant that there was no governmental mechanism to assure a greater expansion of the money supply, especially during panics and depressions, when banks particularly wished to be bailed out and avoid contraction. The national banking system was particularly inelastic, since its issue of notes was dependent on the bank's deposits of government bonds at the Treasury. Furthermore, by the end of the 19th century, government bonds generally sold on the market at 40% over par. This meant that every $1,400 worth of gold reserves would have to be sold by the banks to purchase every $1,000 worth of bonds, preventing the banks from expanding their note issues during a recession. It was following this crisis that a man named Nelson Aldrich, father-in-law of John D. Rockefeller, formed a commission to investigate and propose solutions to fix this, quote, problem of liquidation and money expansion. The Federal Reserve. Nelson Aldrich proposed the Aldrich Plan. Congressman Vreeland, one of the bill's co-authors, had the following to say on the proposal. Quote, "The bank I propose is an ideal method of fighting monopoly. It could not possibly itself become a monopoly, and it would prevent other banks combining into monopolies. With earnings limited to 4.5%, there could not be monopoly." It is important to remember that antitrust legislation was center stage around this time, popularized in particular by the likes of the progressive bull moose, Theodore Roosevelt, with his Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890. This framing of a central bank in the United States being necessary to prevent banking monopolies was crucial to its public acceptance. The reality of how central bank policy affected change could not be further from these claims. Firstly, we know with absolute certainty that the measly 4.5% Vreeland spoke about would fly out the window at the earliest opportunity. But the real wealth concentration monopolization of the Federal Reserve would come in the form of monetary and credit expansion. Secondly, artificial protections from the liquidations of malinvestment is, in effect, a legal monopoly for all beneficiaries, shielding banks from the consequences of market forces which ordinarily naturally direct capital allocation. Cleverly, the Federal Reserve was set to be a private institution, and unelected bureaucrats would reside over its policymaking. This was a convenient loophole to skirt the unconstitutionality of unchecked monetary expansion. Frankly, this relationship is the opposite of antitrust, as private government partnerships both create and sustain cartels via judicial and legislative capture. The most important difference between the Federal Reserve and the national banks of the United States, which had existed in years prior, was the Fed's ability to create the official money of the United States. Paper banknotes issued by the Fed became legal tender for both public and private debts. Notice the Constitution didn't specifically prohibit a private institution from issuing bills of credit, and the government then deeming it legal tender. For all intents and purposes, this was a deliberate obfuscation of U.S. constitutional law. One should note, there is very little presence of a private institution on these illegitimate bills of credit. They take on every role and appearance of being government issue. All of this was a carefully constructed facade to convince the public that the government was working to, quote, break apart the money trust. The public was thoroughly convinced that it was the centralization of financial power in Wall Street which caused the booms and busts actually created by government policymaking. The Aldrich Bill was the reform that promised to fix this problem for the American people. As Griffin put it in his brilliant expose, The Creature from Jekyll Island, a second look at the Federal Reserve. Quote, the public was, of course, outraged, and the pressure predictably mounted for Congress to do something. The monetary scientists were fully prepared to use this reaction to their own advantage. The strategy was simple. 1. Set up a special congressional committee to investigate the money trust. 2. Make sure the committee is staffed by friends of the trust itself. And 3, conceal the full scope of the trust's operation while revealing just enough to intensify the public clamor for reform. Once the political climate was hot enough, the Aldrich Bill could be put forward. Executive Order 6102 and the Emergency Banking Act. The restrictions on new money creation were eased by the FDR administration, with the Federal Reserve turning over all of its gold to the Treasury, under the Gold Reserve Act of 1934. One should note that monetary expansion began to increase in velocity, particularly after the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913 and into World War I. The booming economy of the Roaring Twenties was a result of Mellon's push to lower Federal Reserve interest rates in 1921 and 1924. The availability of cheap credit and cheap capital encouraged once again rampant speculation. In 1928, responding to the fear of a dangerous bubble in the stock market, the Federal Reserve began to raise interest rates. In 1929, the Fed raised interest rates to 6% and yet still failed to stop rampant speculative activity in the markets. Less than 3 months after this rate hike came Black Tuesday, historically one of the worst financial crashes in the history of the United States. Mellon was a strange man. On one hand, he publicly proclaimed his disdain for economic intervention, and yet by 1930 he was already again calling for interest rate cuts, 2% by mid-1930. The four-year devastation caused by the burst of the speculative bubble led to drastic reforms by the FDR administration. The Emergency Banking Act of 1933 was a series of reforms made by the federal government, driven by the FDR administration, to stabilize the banking system. The act came directly on the heels of a nationwide banking holiday declared by FDR. These holidays were intended to halt the widespread bank runs. FDR made a great number of reforms during just the first year of his presidency. The Emergency Banking Act was an amendment to the Trading with the Enemy Act of 1917. Which originally gave the president power to restrict trade between the U.S. and foreign nations during a time of war, in particular World War I. However, The Trading with the Enemy Act was changed to also be usable in times of peace via a congressional amendment. The Emergency Banking Act amendment was passed in a single night of chaos on the Congress floor with such haste that only a single copy was available to the House and was voted on after being read aloud. The act had two significant goals. One, to reaffirm the Federal Reserve's commitment to supply, quote, unlimited currency to banks, which reopened after the end of the banking holiday. And two, establishing a 100% deposit insurance for banks. All of these were temporary measures until the much more cohesive 1933 Banking Act. The 1933 Banking Act was wide in scope. It had many significant goals. Creation of the FDIC. Separation of commercial and investment banking. Creation of the Federal Open Market Committee, FOMC. Reduction in competition between commercial banks. Restriction in speculative uses of bank credit and removal of limits on total amounts of loans that could be made by member banks. Elimination of personal liability for new shareholders of national banks. Tightly regulate national banks to the Federal Reserve, requiring member banks and holding companies to make 3 annual reports given to the Fed. And give national banks the same ability to establish branches in their home state as state-chartered banks. Executive Order 6102 was signed on April 5, 1933. 1 month after the Emergency Banking Act, by President Franklin D. Roosevelt, quote, forbidding the hoarding of gold coin, gold bullion, and gold certificates within the continental United States. This power was made possible by the Emergency Banking Act of 1933. Many are aware of Executive Order 6102 and its implications on the U.S. markets at the time, but few realize that gold ownership actually remained illegal throughout the entirety of the Bretton Woods Agreement, which ran from 1944 to 1971. Quote, the private ownership of gold certificates was legalized in 1964, and they can be openly owned by collectors but are not redeemable in gold. The limitation on gold ownership in the U.S. was repealed after President Gerald Ford signed a bill to permit United States citizens to purchase, hold, sell, or otherwise deal with gold in the United States or abroad, with an act of Congress, which went into effect December 31, 1974. Following this legislation to its logical conclusions, this means that it was actually illegal for U.S. citizens to redeem their U.S. dollars for gold held by the U.S. Treasury under the Bretton Woods system. Executive Order 6102 was a direct an indefinite suspension of the redemption of specie, echoing over a century of similar policymaking surrounding government-induced financial depressions. In other words, paper notes could no longer be redeemed for the gold by which it was supposedly backed. In fact, from 1933 to 1971, this settlement to the base layer of money was a right reserved only for sovereigns. Bretton Woods and the London Gold Pool. From 1961 to 1968, Western banks corroborated in what was known as the London Gold Pool. The United States and a handful of European nations pooled their gold reserves into the London Gold Exchange in an attempt to stabilize the price of gold around the fixed redemption rate of $35 per troy ounce. This monetary experiment, just like every other attempt at market intervention and stabilization, attempt to subvert free market action, failed horribly, and ultimately led to the closing of the gold window by Richard Nixon in 1971. Perhaps it's best to establish a timeline of events here. In 1933, Executive Order 6102 not only made it illegal for U.S. citizens to hold physical gold, but also effectively prohibited them from redeeming treasury notes for gold. With the outbreak of war in Europe, the London Gold Pool closed its operations in 1939, effectively stinting international gold redemption under Bretton Woods, established in 1944, until the London Gold Pool reopened in 1954. Notice here that during this time period, roughly 1933 to 1954, U.S. gold reserves were at their all-time high. Starting in 1961, central banks began cooperating in an attempt to stabilize gold prices via the London Gold Pool by providing excess gold if demand increased and providing buy pressure if demand started to drop. In the first half of the 1960s, the sterling pound was under significant stress from various European geopolitical crises seen below. As a result, increasing amounts of intervention were needed from central banks to maintain desired gold exchange rates. It was well known by sovereign financial ministries that the U.S. was benefiting disproportionately via the dollar peg by exporting inflation and running deficits to benefit from the seigniorage of dollar creation. In 1965, the De Gaulle administration of France, at the direction of the finance minister Jacques Rouff, announced intentions to begin exchanging dollars for gold in an attempt to close this deficit gap and force a return to an international gold standard. These events had significant and expected impacts on the demand and price of the gold markets starting around 1960. A dramatic decrease in U.S. gold reserves occurred, all the way up until the collapse of the London Gold Pool in 1968. In effect, this financial loss can be viewed as central banks, both the U.S. and the Bank of England, attempt to stabilize the London Gold Pool. Here we see the United States fighting the same battle previously fought by the Japanese shogunate, caused by their artificially soft and expansionary monetary policy under bimetallism. Despite the suspension of redemption of specie for all but the sovereign states, artificially soft gold notes were arbitraged for a profit, which could be settled in finality on the base layer money, gold specie. In 1969, the IMF passed legislation allowing the issuance of the SDR, technically the first fiat obligation not backed by a form of gold redemption under the Bretton Woods system, the first step towards the establishment of floating global fiat reserve currencies. As we know, Nixon ended the convertibility of the dollar for gold in 1971, the backbone of the Bretton Woods system, and the adjustable peg disappeared entirely in 1973. For a far more comprehensive look at these events, I would refer you to this research piece. Link to the National Bureau of Economic Research paper, The Gold Pool and the Fall of the Bretton Woods System, Lessons for Central Bank Cooperation. Hopefully, I've given you enough of an overview of these historical events to get a picture of how the incentives of the system disrupt its stability. This topic is complex, and despite the fact that the U.S. dollar was the backbone of the Bretton Woods system, that isn't to say they were the only nation to benefit from inflation and market intervention. Bretton Woods was doomed to fail because of its misaligned incentives. 1971 was yet another form of soft default on obligations, except this time, rather than suspending redemption of specie to her constituency, the U.S. suspended redemption for every nation-state under the Bretton Woods system. And yet, despite this decree of irredeemability for paper to gold, the face value of dollars to gold was still fixed. Historically, this price was what gave the paper notes its value in the first place. Specie was the base layer of money. But paper notes allowed gold to scale in an increasingly complex and global economy. In a case where paper notes can never be redeemed for the underlying specie, the exchange value is set by decree, rather than by the market. Hence the term, fiat. But what's most interesting is how so many great abstractions on top of the monetary system disrupted the common man's ability to reason that paper notes were originally a layer above specie. Rather, he began to think of paper notes as the base layer itself. This was to the great benefit of the nation-state, who found it could create for itself a great deal of funding for a whole manner of twisted machinations at the expense of its currency holders, which could be diluted in mass. Mounting global geopolitical and local socioeconomic pressures put a tremendous amount of stress on the system to continuously debase circulating currency supply to fund the next crisis. To better understand the consequences of indefinite suspension of settlement to the base layer, I suggest looking through a website called WTF Happened in 1971. Liquidation, which was once softened by temporary base layer settlement, has been supplanted by an indefinitely suspended expansionary system. The ripple effects continually grow in magnitude and severity as economic calculations are distorted on a global scale. Look no further than the dot-com bust, the 2008 financial crisis, and the 2020 financial crisis for a glimpse at how unlimited credit expansion and expansionary monetary policy go hand in hand. These are the inevitable results. Increasing amounts of risk and leverage build up in the system, with no way to purge itself beyond one final and total collapse. A new base layer. Let's take another quick break for our sponsor before we get into Bitcoin, how and why it readjusts the incentives and creates a new base layer to potentially even solve this problem for good. Swan Bitcoin is a wonderful place to buy Bitcoin. You can do it automatically every day, every week, every month, whatever. It's low cost. It's Bitcoin only. They don't do any shit coins. You can automatically withdraw. They pay the fees for you. They want you to hold your coins. Yada, yada, yada. That's all great. You've heard it all. But they also have an incredible blog where they publish stuff all the time. Really great writing. Jan Pritzker, their CTO, has still one of my favorite books, and I'm honored to have done the audiobook for it. They also support numerous Bitcoin podcasts in the space. They have their own show, which is just straight fire. They also do tutorials. They break down the best practices for wallets and privacy. They also run Clubhouse rooms to answer anybody's question all the time. They're constantly doing this, and they stay up there for hours helping anybody out that they can. Swan is seriously a company by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners. They are 100% Signal. If you haven't started your savings plan with them, do it at swanbitcoin.com/guy. That is my referral, and it will also help out the show. swanbitcoin.com/guy. A new base layer. Now that we have taken the time to properly understand the history of money, it should be obvious to us that Bitcoin is not a fiat currency. And in fact, it is not so tongue-in-cheek to call many aspects of modern society fiat. They are often, in fact, by decree, rather than of an emergent and voluntary order. It is disruption of settlement to the base layer of money, which has been co-opted so effectively over the last two centuries, which has abstracted away our ability to understand the monetary system. If you look at the markets today, the Federal Reserve's expansion of the money supply and the government's ability to borrow and spend unabated, it seems to simply make no sense. That's because it does not. Credit expansion and the generational postponement of the liquidation of malinvestment is only possible under a system mirrored in numerous layers of decree over a co-opted monetary base layer. Quote, "There is no way to avoid the inevitable bust caused by monetary and credit expansion." Mises. The common argument against Bitcoin proclaims it to be a fiat currency because it is, quote, "not backed by anything." This abstraction assumes that all money must be redeemable for something. But this simply is not so. Gold bars are not redeemable for anything, and yet they were once money. They were, in fact, the base layer of money. Bitcoin has value because people are freely and voluntarily willing to exchange for it at its spot price. It has no peg, no artificial face value, and the settlement stack cannot be given a mandatory holiday. Bitcoin is a new base layer of money, one that, quote, "takes the thing out of the hands of government." F.A. Hayek. The first global self-clearing real-time settled bearer asset, one which solves the problems inherent in scaling precious metals for use at a global economic scale. Bitcoin is an economic social contract with distributed consensus surrounding the rules of play, non-compliant with co-option. A money not prone to the pitfalls of centralized issuance and debasement. A money usable outside of the confines of centralized institutions, which can rehypothecate and postpone the liquidation of notes to settlement on the base layer. A money which sidesteps the inevitable replay of events that would occur under a return to the gold standard. Bitcoin is the first base layer money in which redemption of specie, or final settlement, cannot be suspended without consequence. The right to final settlement will not be afforded exclusively to the sovereign state, but rather any individual may choose to become self-sovereign by simply becoming a willing participant in the network. Despite our storied history of shenanigans, humanity progressed forward in spite of the shaky foundations upon which our economic activity, or the means of making life worth living, was ensconced. Bitcoin is better than a return to the gold standard. Bitcoin is more than a silver squeeze. Bitcoin is a new beginning, a new base layer, an opportunity to transition to a new and better system while the old one goes down in flames. A space for fair, open, and voluntary cooperation outside the prescriptions of tyrants. A fresh start for what humanity could be, instead of unyielding fixations on what it should have been. Bitcoin is not man commanding fiat lux, but rather a genius example of how he makes it so. And that was Fiat Lux, The Origins of Modern Money by Heavily Armored Clown. You know, I think the key takeaway from this, thanks to a Heavily Armored Clown, by the way, for putting this together. This is one of the guys that does the WTF Happened in 1971.com website, which I highly, highly recommend. And actually, I was on, we got to hang out on Peter McCormick's on What Bitcoin Did. I got to do the show with them. And that was a really good one. I'll try to remember to have that in the show notes so you can check out that episode and check out the other stuff that he has written. But I think one of the major takeaways of this piece, and just kind of when we're looking at monetary history in particularly the United States, well, just in general, but particularly here, obviously, we're talking about the United States essentially from inception to today and how we found ourselves in this situation so many times before, and that the story of credit expansion, boom, and bust is an ancient story. It is the story of banking and second layer monetary instruments. It's the story of money. It's just over and over again, we hear this, and it is because of the abstraction between the money that is used and the base layer, the inability, or I guess rather the ability of the banking system to essentially lock people into higher layers of money. And that's really what I love about Nick Bhatia's book, Layered Money, and Heavily Armored Clown talks about it, like takes that same framing of base layer versus higher layer money in this piece that I think is the right way to think about this, is that Bitcoin is the settlement. Gold is the settlement. The higher layer, the abstraction layer, the paper money, the certificates, whatever it is the layer that allows the manipulation, that allows the incredible monetary privilege of the banking sector to profit incredibly from the expansion of the money supply without having to pay the cost of it. And then when they are given the right to do this and then to freeze specie payments, like settlement to the actual money of the economy, what they're doing is they're trapping the cost to the consumer. They're making sure that the cost of their fraud is paid for by the everyday person. And this happens over and over again, and it happens with the national banks. And what we really saw with the Federal Reserve was finally the major banks, the owners, the cronies of the industry, finally getting around the law that was preventing their total control of the banking sector. And it's kind of insane to look back on it in history. I recommend The Creature from Jekyll Island. It's a really great read. I read it really long time ago, but it was one of those pieces, one of those books that really got me down the rabbit hole of what the hell is all this stuff? What is the Federal Reserve, et cetera, et cetera? It should tell us something, that this act, this new law of the banking system to fully monopolize the banking system with a private, quote unquote, a pseudo private institution that was simply designed its way, designed the way it was, simply to get around constitutional law, that this was sold as a way to break the banking monopolies, the cartel of the huge banks of the day that clearly had too much influence and too much control and were engaging in runaway credit expansion, which caused the banking crisis of 1907. And there was so much distrust that they sold this act as a way to end that cartel. And it was literally written by the exact same cartel it was being sold as a solution to. If you look at the example of the 1920s to the crash and into the Great Depression, and you even look at the public sector, like the total debt to GDP of the economy, it's funny because all we have done since essentially the 70s is take what was highly compressed, a debt to GDP ratio that went from about 100% to, I think it was like 400 to somewhere between 400 and 500%. That happened, just crushed, all of it just crushed and squeezed into the decade of the 20s and then crashed in 29. If you look at the debt ratios since 1970, all we've done is taken that exact same problem and stretched it out. The Federal Reserve just got better at managing their boom-bust cycle, and they got better at papering over it when the shit hit the fan. The same collapse of the monetary expansion that caused the Great Depression is not only the exact same situation we find ourselves in towards the end of the 1920s and now over a 50-year cycle in the 2020s, but all of the conditions, all of the expansion, and all of the imbalances between the actual productivity and value of the economy and the amount of debt is worse. All of it is worse than it was at the end of the 1920s. And now they have a total stranglehold on the amount of money, the amount of debt, the interest rates, and the amount of fake capital in the banking system. They have removed the base layer of money entirely so that we are 100% locked. We are trapped. We are caged in their monetary abstraction layer. Bitcoin is a new base layer. It is a new final settlement system, and it is its own money. And it is not by decree, it is by open market value. And we actually have the potential to relegate this problem to the pages of history. All those price fixings between silver and gold and over one jurisdiction and another, between one national currency and another, and the inability to achieve settlement, to say only nation states can settle, U.S. citizens can't. All of these problems are explicitly enabled because they control the international reins. The connections over borders, the settlement between nation states, the ownership and storage of the base layer money is completely and easily controlled by the government. It is too centralized for this problem to not arise at some point. It's just a matter of time. If we ever get back to it, if we ever, by some random, insane chance, went back to a gold standard, it would fail for all the same reasons in all the same ways. But Bitcoin is a necessarily global market. There is no jurisdiction when you move the money. There is no way for them to price fix between one or the other. There is no way for them to actually stop anyone who wants to from settling on the base layer. And the higher layers, as they are being built today, aren't even abstractions. They're actually contractual arrangements for the settlement of base layer money. They are themselves direct and final. This will literally change everything about money. This is uncheatable money. And I always love a good history lesson. This is based on a really great book, The History of Money and Banking by Rothbard. I will have a link to this article and a number of the other things mentioned in this in the show notes, so you can go check it out. Don't forget to follow Heavily Armored Clown. Always great stuff. And check out WTFHappenedIn1971.com. And thank you for listening to Bitcoin Audible. Thank you to our sponsors, The Bitbox from Shift Crypto. Coupon code Guy. Don't forget, you get a discount. And SwanBitcoin.com/Guy for your automatic savings plan in the new base layer money, which is going to relegate these problems to the pages of history. And with that, thank you guys so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to Bitcoin Audible and follow me on Twitter. I am the Guy Swan, the one and only, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. Thank you for listening. And until next time, take it easy, guys. This has been Bitcoin Audible, a 111 production.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.